So thanks for the opportunity to speak here. It's always a pleasure to be back at KATP. So the subject of the talk today is correlation functions of closed string vertex operators. And well, generic correlation functions of this kind are perhaps not as perfect as the most perfect microscopic structures in the universe. Yet nevertheless, there are lots of reasons to think about them. So one of them is relation to amplitudes, which Emery and Gregory talked a lot in past weeks. And I may have something to say about that towards the end of the talk. By the way, how much time do I have? And then if we think about solving a conformal field theory, there are several approaches one can take. One of them would involve listing all the dimensions of operators and all of their correlation functions. And moreover, if nothing particularly nasty happens, all of these can be obtained from basic building blocks via sewing. Let me write this. So in a sense, for such theories, correlation functions are simple things. We would like to know all of these guys, all three-point functions as a function of coupling and positions and everything else. And once we know them, at least in principle, we should, oh yeah, also the conformal blocks. And once we know them in principle, we know everything. Needless to say, this is difficult. And then in the same spirit, and for n equals to 4 super Young-Mills, if we solve one such CFT, we actually solve two CFTs. That would be n equals to 4, and also the 2D theory, the Wolschi theory for strings in ADS 5 cross S5. So that actually comes with one assumption, and the assumption is the following, that the correspondence is formulated essentially in the same spirit as it is formulated for BPS states, namely the following. The correlation function of such a generating function in n equals to 4 theory is presumably equal to the correlation function of such objects. Oh, maybe I should put it the other way. So these guys are local gauge invariant operators in n equals to 4 theory, whereas these guys are vertex operators for the string states, which are dual to these guys. And perhaps I should say that while this is easy to state, the relation between vertex operators and operators is generically, constructing such a relation is generically an open question. We know how to do this for, say, BPS operators and for a small class of other operators, but if you go to sufficiently large charges and so on, then there are ambiguities in exactly how you construct such identifications, essentially, because there are quantum numbers or almost quantum numbers here which don't have an immediate analog on this side. So, and then there's a fourth reason. This bit here, the dimensions of operators, as we've learned, they are controlled by integrability. At the same time, it is plausible that these three-point functions are not immediately controlled by integrability, or at least not completely controlled by integrability. So if we understand how to compute these guys exactly, and perhaps to all orders in the coupling constant, then we are bound to learn something new. Exactly what that new stuff is a priori not clear, but presumably there is something new in there to be learned. So so this is sort of the philosophical part of the motivation. And then there is sort of a more pragmatical part, namely that to date not much is known about these correlation functions. We know some things about correlation functions of BPS operators computed in the early days of the ADS-CFT correspondence, and then perhaps not so early days in recent years for four-point functions. But generically, we don't know much at strong coupling. At weak coupling, we do know a little bit more, and you've heard about that from Pedro Vieira not long ago. So I should probably say here's a list of references, and what I'm going to say somewhere down the road in the talk is based on this paper that Arkadiy Tsaykin and I wrote last year. So to get to what I meant to say, let's have a closer look at this and specify a little bit the two sides and figure out what constraints are imposed by symmetries such that we actually figure out exactly what we want to compute. And in principle, I can just state what those constraints are. But there's a little bit of discussion to be made, especially about the right side here. So what do I mean by this? Notice that there's a different phi on the two sides. So what I mean by phi dot O is the following. It's integral over d4x phi of x some O of x. And this operator is perhaps your favorite trace z to the j, or maybe another local operator. Now, this other guy, oh yeah, in ADS-CFT, these guys play the role of boundary sources for the supergravity, for the string fields. So this side is something of the following kind, d4x, it should also be phi of x on the one hand, times v of x. Now, a standard vertex operator is not really parametrized by some random parameters. It's parametrized by the world sheet coordinates. So this should also be writable as v to psi, phi of psi, u of x of psi, z of psi, and other things of psi. So these are psi are two-dimensional coordinates. And x, z, and perhaps other coordinates are, say, the ADS 5 cross S 5 coordinates. And these guys up here, they are supposed to be just parameters on the boundary. These x's are supposed to be the same x's as here, but from the string theory perspective, they are just labels of vertex operators. They don't play any dynamical role. They do, however, have an action of the four-dimensional conformal group. So let's see. What can this be? So, oh yeah, I should actually draw a picture here. So this is the boundary of ADS, which is where n equals to 4 lives. And this is the world sheet. We're going to restrict to a spherical world sheet. And this is this point psi, which appears in here. And somehow this capital phi is supposed to take a point on the boundary labeled by these x's and propagate it to this point on the world sheet. And then this point on the world sheet is integrated over. So from this picture, you can immediately imagine exactly what this phi of psi is. Oops, the other phi. Right. So this phi of psi should be something like d4x, the source that we want to insert, and then some kind of a propagator in flat. Yeah.
So why isn't the picture that that point on the world sheet is going all the way out to the boundary?
It really is going, but for the purpose, well, it actually depends. So if we think about a semi-classical picture, which I'm going to get to, then this point will sort of morally touch the boundary, and this picture is something like this.
Right.
And then it opens up into something else. But if we think of a small vertex operator that doesn't have a back reaction on the world sheet, it's just one insertion point, one puncture, then this is really, I was about to say this, it's really the analog of e to ikx in flat space. And I'm going to make that a little bit more precise in 5 minutes. So actually, I was about to make it precise right now. So it's something like this, something that we usually call k of x. And it is the famous Bock boundary propagator. So this is actually q of x minus x prime and z. And it looks like the following. Oh, I should say. Uh, I'm going to stick to the Poincaré patch for most of the talk. So this guy is the following. Is determined by the dimension of the field of the string field, by the dimension of the operator or the energy of the string field. And it looks like this. It has a nice property that it is an eigenfunction of the Laplace operator in ADS, which is why I would like to identify it with the ADS analog of e to ikx. But in about 5 minutes, as I was promising, I'll make a close analogy between this and e to ikx. There's a choice of coordinates which makes this clear. Right, so that's the story. So if we want to compute correlation functions of these guys, of these v's, we need to worry about correlation functions of these v's, which really look like k times these u's. And these v's are functions of these positions x, boundary positions, these guys, and functions of psi. Okay? So, yeah.
So the psi dependence arises through the embedding.
Yeah, I should. One of these guys is here. This x prime should be thought of as x prime of psi. And also z of psi. Right, so this point here, its image on the boundary and inside ADS is some function of psi. And this propagator takes us to one specified point on the boundary, the one where we want to insert this other fellow. All right. So constraints, there isn't much to be said. You already know what the constraints are. What are the constraints I'm about to say? In n equals to 4, a two-point function looks like some coefficient c12 divided by x minus y to 2 delta. And there is a restriction that delta 1 has to be equal to delta 2, otherwise this thing is 0 for properly normalized operators. And also for properly normalized operators, we should probably choose the c12 to be 1, but that's a trivial rescaling. The three-point function is c1 to 3, which typically is a function of the Tooft coupling, and then x12, the 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3 times two more factors, exactly like this, 1, 3, delta 1 minus delta 2 plus delta 3, and so on. Okay, so formally, this is these are the guys that we'd like to compute, or perhaps not those guys, but c1 to 3 tilde, which is c1 to 3, divided by c12, c13, c23, to the power one half, right? So this removes the normalization of the two-point function and gives something that's normalization independent.
What about speed?
All right, yes. So here I cavalierly chose just scalar operators. If we want to include spin, then these guys will carry some indices, the O's will carry some indices, and there is a tensor structure which is also determined by conformal invariance both here and there.
But it's not fully determined, that's the point. For three-point functions, we have...
Well, but these are just three-point functions. Four-point functions, we will, at least in principle, get them via sewing. But this story is about three-point functions. So.
Yeah, but if you have spin, there are ambiguities in that. Conformal symmetry doesn't fix all the structure.
Even for three-point? Sorry? Even for three-point functions? Well, then there will be several constants. Okay, that's fine. Right, so this is in n equals to 4. On the string worksheet, the story is a little bit more complicated. So let's have a look at these guys. So there are really two sets of symmetries that restrict this these correlation functions. Right, there is on the one hand target space conformal symmetry, and there is two-dimensional conformal symmetry. So with this, there is something of the following kind. There's an analog of that C12, which is not the same, X12 norm to the 2 delta 1. And then there is a delta of delta 1 minus delta 2, which is, and then maybe some delta functions forcing charges to be equal. And then there is also something related to disk size, which is where little delta is the two-dimensional dimension, which is really 2. Okay. And then to get something that we would like to compare with this, we should take this guy and integrate it over Xi1 and Xi2 to account for this integration here. And there are some subtleties with things that diverge and things that are zero. So this guy is nominally zero because it contains a 1 over the volume of SL2, and that should be canceled by a divergence coming from this integral and the divergence from this delta function. And strictly speaking, this was never successfully demonstrated that it happens except in ADS3, but that's a separate story. It should work something like this. And then there is an analog of this guy for three-point functions. So there is a C1 to 3 divided by these guys, the same ones. And then there is another factor, which is like this one, Xi12 to the 2, Xi23 to the 2, Xi13 to the 2. So this part is fixed by target space conformal invariance. This part is fixed by two-dimensional conformal invariance. And again, one is supposed to integrate these guys. This one is again nominally zero, and the zero should be canceled by divergence from this integral. And what we would really like to compute and perhaps compare, if we are strong enough to do calculations with strong coupling here, is this C tilde with a similar ratio constructed out of this guy and this guy and the corresponding integration constants from here. Okay, so this is the story. So the idea would be to compute these guys. So how do we compute them? Well, in flat space, we write vertex operators. We put them in a path integral, and we compute. We compute weak contractions, and then we integrate over the moduli space, and so on. Now, there is something interesting that happens in special circumstances. So pretty much all vertex operators in flat space have such a factor. And if things like the dot products of these guys, so this is so T stands for the inverse of the string tension. So if K1 dot K2 is of the order of the string tension, which is 1 over alpha prime, then something interesting happens. Namely, there is a competition between these factors and these factors as far as the path integral is concerned. And then the path integral can be computed in a saddle point approximation. This is the old work of Gross and Mende, of course. And it's been successfully used for computation of open string scattering, or sorry, open string correlation functions in exactly the same context in ADS. So it should, at least morally, it should work for the right choice of V1, V2, V3 for closed string vertex operators too. So the idea is, though, to find what are the constraints that the operators should satisfy for such a semi-classical approximation to be valid. So in particular, we would like to identify the cases in which vertex operators look like something something that's large, and perhaps other things here. But we would like to have some factor that's raised to a large power. And this large power should be comparable with the string tension, which in ADS is of the order of square root of lambda up to factors of pi. So we can probably immediately see when this happens. Namely, the vertex operators, as I was trying to argue here, they typically have this factor here, and it's naturally raised to power delta. So these delta should be large. In particular, when delta is of the order of square root of lambda, then semiclassics should work. And we do know lots and lots and lots of operators which obey this. For example, this one. And there are others, of course. Okay, so now I guess I would really have to argue that this K better be there, otherwise I'm in trouble. So to see this, it's useful, at least morally, to think about the flat space limit and this particular structure which appears there. So in the flat space limit, we have this e to I kx, which is also V flat. Is e to minus, it contains a minus IET. Right. So there is an ADS analog for this, though not in these particular coordinates that I used here, but in other ones, which I've collected for your convenience in here. So there is something called global coordinates in ADS, and this is the relation between the global coordinates and the coordinates in which ADS is simple. It's just a hyperboloid. Yes?
Just a reminder, so these states have mass that's fixed in the limit of large radius, is that right?
These ones?
Yeah,
so the dimension of these guys is, so these guys are BPS operators, and yeah, the dimension is actually, so delta is the same as, the number is J, this J, and it's just a number. And the reason is fixed is because, so these states are really the BMN vacuum in the BMN string. So it's represented by a particle that moves and spins with some density of J. And for finite density of J, then the actual charge is J times root lambda. So this is root lambda. And it's set, it doesn't move. So, I would like to write something like that in ADS coordinates, because if we do that, then we should be able to sort of move a little bit away from flat space and see what happens. So this is the translation between global coordinates in which flat space limit is easy and other coordinates in which ADS doesn't really care about what coordinates you put on it. So this thing should be something like y5 plus iy0. To what power? To the minus e. Right. And now we would like to transform this to coordinates in which this thing is written, which are the Poincaré patch coordinates. So the map is written down here. And also there is another bit that we should keep in mind. We usually compute correlation functions, or at least I want to compute correlation functions for Euclidean boundary. So I want to do a weak rotation. Namely, flip that sign. This will lead to some more changes, which I'm not about to explain, and also to a weak rotation of the boundary. And then, so these are energies, string energies. We would like, you know, when we talk about operators, it's more natural to use their dimension rather than the energy of something. So we need to do a conformal transformation too, which is essentially interchanges y0 and y4. So if you don't believe me, just ask Murat and he will explain you why this is the case. So once you do this, then this e to minus IET transforms into something nice. Y5 plus Y4 to the power minus delta. Okay? So if you go back to my table here and construct y5 plus y4, you see that the plus one and minus one cancels, and you get exactly this particular combination here. So this is really just k, at least proportional to k. So I should say here there is some coefficient which needs to be adjusted if you want to get a genuine Green's function and not some bizarrely normalized Green's function. So I guess one can say that if one wants vertex operators that have a nice flat space limit and reduce to at least things that we believe to exist in all flat space vertex operators, then this k should always be there in some form. So this actually justifies why for operators with large dimension, one should be able to use semi-classical approximation at some level. Now, so just to add a picture. So in this setup, a graphical representation of the correlation of the surface that would saturate the correlator would be something like this, exactly like Steve was anticipating. And you should think of this as a sphere which is deformed by fixing three points, pulling them to the boundary, and you get something like, well, something that when drawn properly looks much better.
So these are excited string states going out to the boundary, I guess.
Yeah, some of them, that's right.
Of the mass. Well, it's these things, with these deltas, they all have, they correspond to string exit.
This one can be thought of as a very high KK mode of something, this particular one. But you're certainly right. Eventually, I will want to talk about excited string states which do this. Okay. If you're worried how they can if you're worried how they can reach the boundary, then I'm getting there.
Yeah, without fragment.
Well, it's because of the Euclidean continuation that I did.
Well, if one was dealing with Lorentzian ADS, is there some analogous physics that you can point to?
Well, the short answer is I don't know, but let me think about it.
Actually, the reason I'm confused about these, whether these are KK modes or string modes, is, again, because of the scaling I asked about it.
Yeah, but
lambda goes like r to the fourth, right?
Yeah.
So that's delta goes like.
Yeah, but they're also protected. So I mean, one should read it like this rather than like delta of order lambda. It's just delta, which is very, very large, and it is artificially made to scale like root lambda. But this is really the relation that one should worry about: delta equal to j. And also from a string perspective, if you look at the whole geometry, then these guys correspond to one to a point like particle moving on a null geodesics, even though from ADS perspective it's certainly not null. So the sphere, the motion on the sphere, the one that contributes to J, makes it null. And that also, that's what makes it protected. And
if your operators are protected, the three-point functions are protected as well.
I'm getting there.
So what is it that you want?
I'm getting there. This was just an example, OK? It was an example that was supposed to be very familiar. Now, I can't really write down a non-trivial example because it's a little long, but the point of the talk will be to get to non-trivial examples. Right, so this is the story about this fact here. I guess I haven't specified anything about this U. So this U is the flat space analog, is the ADS analog of the things that in flat space look like these guys. Right, it's the analog of the prefactors that we put in vertex operators to carry spin, other quantum numbers, and whatnot. So these guys are the analogs of these. So to actually compute something, we need to make some choices for these guys. And the choices for them, the simplest way to make choices for them if you want to preserve symmetries is to write them in terms of these embedding coordinates on which the ADS isometries act linearly. So okay, so here are some examples. I guess the simplest one, which also is also protected, but the reason I'm writing it is because it's useful to have some protected fellow which we can use to probe things and get zeros when we expect to get zeros. So this is the dilaton. This is its corresponding vertex operator was computed a long time ago. Let's see. There are two people, Zarembo and Bernstein, Corrado, Maldacena, and Fischler. So in these coordinates, it looks like the following. So it's this y plus, which is this guy, y plus to the power delta, and then minus delta. And then perhaps we want some Kaluza-Klein mode of it, which is J. And then there is this factor here, which looks like this. Oops. And this would be the longest formula, right? So the story today is only about classical stuff, so let me not worry about fermions. But if you're worried why this thing looks so familiar, it should be familiar. It's really just the string Lagrangian, the bosonic string Lagrangian in ADS5 crosses 5. And the reason it should be this way is that if you put that bosonic string in a generic supergravity background, then it looks like this. And the vertex operator is just d by d phi of this guy at phi equal to 0. So that's what this is. And this phi is the guy, is the phi that exists on the world sheet being constructed out of the source and this k. So taking d by d boundary source produces this guy and this part. And if we want a kk mode of that, we just add it in the wave function. So the observation that this is just d by d phi, and the fact that that's something sort of obvious, gives us a nice handle on correlation functions involving dilaton vertex operators. So if this is just d by d phi, then one can think of it also as, at least morally, as lambda d by d lambda, where lambda is the toothed coupling. And why this is so is because in the D3 brain action, you have e to the phi, some number, trace f square. So d by d phi brings down a trace f square, which is the operator that's dual to the dilaton. But the constant part of the dilaton is also the toothed coupling. So d by d lambda introduces the same operator. So with this observation, one can morally say that the three-point functions of the type this are something like lambda d by d lambda of two-point functions of just these two guys without this. And this is correct, but this is not entirely correct. It is morally correct, but it's not entirely correct because this is really not the full dilaton vertex operator constructed this way, but it's an integrated dilaton vertex operator because this enters in here. Right, so there is, if you look at these guys and you try to integrate, for example, this over the third coordinate, you get a divergence, and then there is a potential ambiguity in exactly how that is regulated. I will most likely not get to it, but there is an extra factor which is important that comes out of that regularization. Anyhow, so this kind of observations are useful, and they do imply that this kind of three-point functions should at least be proportional to lambda d by d lambda of the dimension of these guys, of this v. Right, so let me proceed to something else. Now there is there are some other operators which.
So the dimension of which of the two?
This one. Well, as a two-point function, they're required to be equal, so.
They have to be the same, unless, but you will have non-vanishing three-point functions also.
Not if you have, so if you have dilaton delta 1, delta 2, then it will not be non-zero. No more questions? All right. So there were three more vertex operators that I meant to tell you about, but in view of the time, I'm going to tell you about only one. And that's a state on the leading graduate trajectory, which the flat space version of which I wrote here. And you'll not be surprised that the corresponding ADS version is just okay. And perhaps some Kaluza-Klein version, some Kaluza-Klein mode of that, and then. So I'm glossing over things, and I'm not going to get into what I'm glossing over unless you ask. But so this is a vertex this is a vertex operator for a state on the leading graduate trajectory that has spin s and perhaps angular momentum j on s5. Okay. So that's the story about v's. Now what about the actual correlator? So what one would really like to do is to actually go back to this equation, which unfortunately I just erased. Take these guys, put them in the exponent, extract the equations of motion with these sources, solve the equations of motion with those sources, and evaluate them. And evaluate this this object on that on the solution to those equations. So formally, the action looks like this, the modified action. Sum over the vertex operators. So these will clearly generate sources as we take d by d world sheet fields from here, and one is supposed to solve that. For two-point functions, a solution to this is known for any choice of operators. And the way to construct that solution is sort of clear. Well, it's not immediately obvious, no? So as Steve rightfully mentioned, if we're in global coordinates and we look at a particle, at a massive particle that sits in the middle and doesn't do anything fancy, it just sits there. And if we look in the Poincaré patch, this is the boundary, and it will wiggle around. But the distance between this geodesics and the boundary is always non-zero. Right? So. A classical solution describing this is t equals kappa tau. And then this one is just z equals 1 over cosine of kappa tau.
It goes outside of the horizon, doesn't it? The Poincaré horizon.
Yeah, well, very far away it will sort of reach the boundary, but. Yeah, but then we don't really have control over those points in the sense that if we would like to bring them, say, at finite distance, then we can't really, right? Yeah, whereas here, we would like the freedom to insert those. So the idea would be that the point where this guy reaches the boundary would be the point where we insert the operators. But if we can't move those off those points at random positions where we might want them, then that's not really good enough.
Well, I'm just saying if you have something going straight up the middle, and you look what that maps to, it's something coming out of the horizon and going back, I think, isn't it? Out of the Poincaré horizon.
Um, not about to argue against that. At the same time, if you use those transformations from there, then this is what you get. And then you get some, well, you're right. There are, I mean, these guys do eventually go to zero, and Z will eventually go to infinity. Maybe I should have drawn this in a sort of tilted way. But anyway, the thing that I mean to say is that this will never reach the boundary. But it will reach the boundary once you do this, and then that's better. Thanks. It will reach the boundary upon this transformations, and then it just looks like this. These points sit at definite positions where tau e is plus or minus infinity, so x is plus or minus 1. But that's okay, we can use conformal transformations to move them around. And one can check that, and it's been checked in this paper, this one. It's been checked that these points introduce the right kind of sources for this geodesics to correspond to just one point particle with vertex operator just k, or y plus to the minus delta. And the same has been checked for one of these guys. Am I pointing in the right spot? No, it was for a vertex operator on the leading radial trajectory. So and the expectation is that this procedure will always work. And it doesn't work, if it doesn't work exactly in this terms, it can be modified only slightly and it will work again. So one would like very much to do exactly the same with three vertex operators. And the problem is that we don't really know how to do this. Yet we would like to do something about it. And well, once you have some kind of a solution, which is really not the problem you want, but it's sort of closely related to it, you might want to try perturbations. So instead of looking for three-point functions of operators with all of which have large charges, it should presumably be enough to relax the requirement that one of them has large charges. And then in the equations of motion, that third source can be treated as a perturbation. And then everything should be determined by the two-point function of these guys, which do carry large charges. So the idea would be that if you actually work out what the words I said mean, so this means that the dimension is of order root lambda for both of these. And for this one, the dimension is much less than root lambda. It doesn't need to be fixed. It can still be much less than root lambda without being fixed. For example, it can be lambda to the 1/4. Of course, this can be BPS, so it can be fixed. But the point is that it should not scale like root lambda, then the source can be set aside. And well, delta being that operator being BPS was discussed here, and that operator not being BPS but scaling like lambda to the 1/4 was discussed in our paper with Arkady. So anyway, putting some equations next to the words I said implies the following, that this object is the following. So it's it should again be something like this, evaluated on the real solution. But now, to leading order, the real solution is the two-point function, is the solution giving the two-point function of these guys. So that's exactly what this bar with index means. just take this stuff, evaluate it on the classical solution, giving the two-point function of the two operators with large delta, and then you're done. So one can also be a little bit sneaky and not worry too much about these guys by defining a normalized three-point function. And one can also be a little bit more careful with positions. And if that is the case, one gets the following. And then it's just, so this comes out to be just VL. And then if one actually wants to extract the coefficient, the normalized three-point function coefficient, it is something of the following kind. And so one can be a little bit more careful and not put any particular numbers for the insertion points, and then one can check whether indeed the calculation preserves target space conformal symmetry in the sense that this factor will come out, and it does come out. This was checked somewhere here. So anyhow, this is the story. And since I'm running out of time, let me discuss a couple of examples and some general features that come out of this kind of calculation, and then get to the part that might be of interest here, namely these comments. So,
so how does it scale with lambda now, the constant?
Not as you expect.
So how does it?
So, because it's a semi-classical calculation, you'd expect this to scale like e to the root lambda. It doesn't, because there is nothing that's that large in this vertex operator. So it scales perhaps polynomially with root lambda. And that's OK. There is no real contradiction. What's the consequence of that as far as amplitudes I'm going to get to? But I guess you can guess what the consequence is.
You're going to tell us.
Yes. I hope I will. if I can get 10 more minutes. All right. So, it is certainly possible, though perhaps not particularly legal, to invent some e to the root lambda dependence in here. So the way to do it is to think of this, to think of a sequence of operators with small dimensions, but that which have a parameter that you can tune and artificially make that parameter large after you've done the calculation. And then indeed there is an e to the root lambda dependence that comes out. And one of the examples that I will show you actually does have this feature. But that's really not a particularly legal thing to do, especially because once that you have that parameter that's large, it already appears as some kind of exponent, and then it is perhaps more natural to think of it as the source already contributing in a non-trivial way to the solution. Anyhow, so we are to these examples here. So I'm going to take this heavy operators to be states on the leading Regger trajectory. Namely, their operators are supposed to be these ones. And for starters, the light one, I'm going to take to be the dilaton. Okay? So, these states We know how they are represented in ADS. They are just spinning folded strings. And if we add some angular momentum for them, there is that bit too. So this is the classical solution that one should worry about. I'm going to write just this one. Mu sigma . So notice that it is not a real solution, but that's okay since it's a saddle point. Notice that as a function of tau, it also reaches the boundary. So sigma runs from 0 to 2 pi, and tau runs from minus infinity to infinity, and this is Euclidean time. So it reaches the boundary at large values of tau equals plus or minus infinity. And I mean, if you take this and the vertex operator, this vertex operator, plug one into the other and evaluates this, you get something which looks like this. So there is this normalization of the vertex operator. It's actually very simple. And one is supposed to integrate this. And it is computable analytically. Just get a bunch of 2F1s if you care. And the fact that you can compute it analytically is not really the part that's interesting. The part that is interesting, there are the limits for this thing. So one limit is that one can take a very formal limit in which this folded string turns into a BPS state. Heavy BPS state. Let's see. Anybody has an expectation what should come out of this? So two heavy BPS states and the delta. There are no, well, a BPS state is a supergravity state. There are no real couplings between supergravity states of any kind and the dilaton. So this should be zero. And it happens. If you do the integral and you take the limit, then you do get zero. The other thing that, the other thing that one might be able to take, so this J here, I didn't mention what it is. So this J is a label for the Kaluza-Klein model of the dilaton. So if we take J to 0 to get the real dilaton, then delta, which is the dimension of the dilaton, turns into 4. So where this guy equals 0, this guy equal to 4, this thing turns into something that resembles, that looks like this. It's something proportional to log S over square root of j square plus lambda over pi square log s square. And this is proportional to d by d lambda of this thing and you may or may not remember that this is actually the dimension of the operator dual to the folded string.
So this was now what configuration did you put on?
It's exactly the same. It's all buried in this integral. So take j equal to 0, delta equal to 4, and expand at large s, and fixed. And then you get this. So this is supposed to be a confirmation of this idea that the dilaton vertex operator is something like lambda d by d lambda. Notice, however, that I used proportional and not equal. If you look at it, there is a log s difference, and that's an important log s because it's a very large number. And the origin of this log s has to do with the fact that, so I was mentioning, d by d lambda is really the integrated vertex operator, and it's not the vertex operator itself. And it's really that the natural regulator ends up being proportional to log s because it's a world sheet regulator, and it's log s, which is kappa, is the only object that carries dimension, so that accounts for the large difference between the two. Now, the last thing that I'm going to mention is that one can take another configuration in which this light guy is also something on the leading Reggie trajectory, except it has a much smaller spin. So this would be a three-point function of things that all of which are non-BPS. So it's the same H leading Reggie trajectory. And the light guy is also on the leading Reggie trajectory, except that it has some spin that's smaller and some dimension delta that's also smaller. And well, the answer is something. It doesn't really matter what it is. At least not for the purpose of the talk. But what is interesting to notice, however, is that it has the following structure. It's log s, the log of the spin of the heavy guy, to the little s minus 2. So generically, it has something like the dimension of the heavy guy to something like the string level. Of the light guy. Okay. So notice that if I artificially take this guy and make it large, then I do get an exponential scaling with root lambda. But again, like I said, this is presumably illegal. Anyhow, this is the bit that I would like to emphasize, this structure. And of course, you might wonder whether one example is enough to make a conjecture. Well, worse things happen in history, I guess. But this actually does seem to be fairly generic. We tried a collection of other light operators, which are non-BPS. And we tried other choices of heavy guys. And this structure appears to be generic. All of them, all such three-point functions, have this particular behavior. Right. So that's roughly all the neat that I wanted to tell you about. So there are a few things that would be interesting to do, of course. Namely, it would certainly be interesting to figure out how to do real three-point functions with heavy operators. And while there are yet no examples of how to do this, some framework was set forth by Vicedo not too long ago. Somehow he manages to try to use integrability to construct the solution for these equations with sources. It would of course be interesting to make contact with weak coupling. There are conjectures of exactly how the contact should be made, and there are conjectures that sort of parallel expansion around BMN, where there is non-denormalization of certain terms, which are characterized by certain J dependence. Similar conjectures have been put forth by Russo, Zeitlin, and I think that's it, at some point last year. I was mentioning in the beginning that endpoint functions can be computed via sewing. But then again, if you have two heavy operators and any number of light operators, you can, of course, try to apply this strategy to that case. And this was tested for four-point functions. And at least for two dilaton insertions, the result is consistent with this idea that the dilaton vertex operator is lambda d by d lambda. And it seems to also be consistent, though in a somewhat trivial way to quote the authors, with non-randomization theorems for extremal four-point functions. So, well, once we figure out how to do this, it would, of course, be interesting to try to go to higher point functions, perhaps not only for the sake of doing that, but also for making contact with the type of correlation functions that Emery and Gregory talked about last week's. So let me close with a few comments regarding those and how they fare in connection with these kind of correlation functions. So let me start with a few trivial remarks. The first one is that the correlation functions computed in the supergravity approximation are certainly not the ones that we want. And that is for two reasons. One of them, well, the first one, perhaps the most important one, have no square root of lambda dependence, at least not the expected one. No, better said, no e to the root lambda dependence. And the second one is that they are not sufficiently singular. So for a for a correlator of this kind, the expectation is that it should behave like x12 to some power, x23 to some power, none of which is 0, x34 to some power, x41 to some power, to match the tree-level correlator in at weak coupling. And if you actually take, say, this example of four-point functions computed not too long ago, they certainly are not dissingular. They have only a couple of these guys at some other powers, but they're not these ones. So these supergravity correlators are not the good ones. Yet we do compute them. So how can this be consistent? No root lambda dependence with the root lambda dependence. Well, the claim is that this is an order of limit issue. Right? So presumably, this correlator would behave like the following. Some polynomial of root lambda divided by, well, some function of x, which is what is captured by supergravity. And then some exponential corrections times some other function g of x. Right? So if we take large root lambda limit for a generic for generic positions, then we capture this. However, if we take the large lambda limit for light-like separations, we should capture this. Well, then it's sort of clear. This guy should be more singular than this, but we don't see it because in supergravity we start with generic points and we first take root lambda large. So somehow we should, if we are to, yet no matter what else we do, we still won't capture this as a supergravity object. So we have to do something else. So of course, this kind of scaling smells semi-classical. And unfortunately, we can't really play semi-classics with stress tensors because they're light. Their dimension is 4, so certainly not a scale like root lambda. Fortunately, the conjecture says that we can replace these guys with some heavier guys. Maybe I should write higher up. The conjectures that we should be able to replace some or perhaps all of them with heavy guys. And in fact, at least for MHV amplitudes, this can be proven fairly rigorously. So let's try something like trace of z to the j plus 2, trace of z bar to the j plus 2, So I've replaced two of them with these guys, which are presumably heavy with large J. So one should be able to use semi-classics for that. Well, the story is unfortunately not done. I'm not about to tell you what this is, because I'm not about to tell you that this gives the right answer, because it doesn't. What it does, so based on the semi-classical arguments that I've described, and this has been spelled out here, this correlator, let me call this 1, 2, 3, 4, this is something like the following: 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 4, over 1, 2. Right? So it factorizes into three-point functions, just because, as I was trying to describe, this is just the product of these two vertex operators evaluated on the classical solution describing that two-point function. So it has a factorized structure. And really, this factorized structure has exactly the same problems as these guys. It does not have e to the minus root lambda dependence, even though this part is semi-classical. Well, it's essentially Jan's question. And it's not sufficiently singular. In particular, it's missing this 1 over x3, 4. Oops, the other 3, 4, to some power. So this is not good either. So unfortunately, we are stuck to needing to consider four, or at least three heavy guys. So if we know how to do three heavy, we could, of course, try this one. And this might actually work, because already this this bit will have the e to the root lambda dependence. But since we don't know what this is, I can't tell you what this is either. But this is yet more reasoning to actually try to construct these correlation functions. Now, in the remaining minus 2 minutes, sorry for going over time that much. So in the remaining minus 2 minutes, let me tell you, let me describe a little bit what the relation between amplitudes and correlation functions might suggest. So I was trying to argue in the beginning that higher point correlation functions can be computed via sewing. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4. Let me be bold. So this should be something, this could be something like this. Sum over x, 1, 2, 3, x, some conformal block, x, 3, x, 4, 5, 6. OK?
We have to use spin. X must have spin.
Absolutely. I have no doubt about that. Now, Emery was briefly mentioning that this conjecture between for this relation between amplitudes and correlators might actually extend beyond just correlation functions of protected operators, but it might go to non-protected operators. If this is indeed the case, then one might hope that each of these two factors, it has some relation to a squared amplitude, just like this one. So this is an A square. And whatever this x would mean this time, square, sorry, the other x. So here we have another example, well, of something like the bootstrap relation that Aldai, Gaiotto, Maldacena, Severin, Vieira came up with a couple of differences. There is a linear relation in amplitudes. This would be something involving squared amplitudes. And the other thing is that, well, this involves, well, in the best case scenario, this would be itself an amplitude. In the worst case scenario, it's a correlator that's closely related to an amplitude. because it differs from an amplitude by just the insertion of a single other thing. So it would, of course, be interesting to try to dissect this and see what it implies, and perhaps what it implies in conjunction with their version of a bootstrap relation. And once you have one and two as exponents, there is nothing that would stop you to wonder whether such a relation might exist. But since I have nothing really to say about this last line, let me stop here before you start throwing tomatoes at me.
This intriguing relation you have, that heavy light, and then you have dimension of h, dimension of heavy to the power of the string levels of the light. So how do you count string levels? Would Kanishi be level 1 or level 2?
Are you worried about that minus 2?
No, I'm just asking because, I mean, we have one example. I mean, we at one loop. I mean, okay, the question is, in any case, how does it generalize to weak coupling? If you have Kanishi with any two other operators, the result is just proportional to dimension of Kanishi plus dimension, two times the dimension of the other. So it has to be diagonal in the heavy state. So it would be power 1, that's what I want to say.
Right.
You observe power 1. So it would be in agreement with your formula.
Okay, I should know this, but I... Okay. So this is another thing that I meant to say, skipped it. Sorry, Zvi, for really going over time. So there is one operator which is sort of interesting in this respect, which looks like this. It's a singlet. And in some sense, one might contemplate associating it with Konishi. Now, this guy has the corresponding three-point function scales like log s to the 2r minus 2. So if you want something that... So Konishi would be something involving four of these guys at least. Well, see, here is a little bit of an issue because it depends very much whether you count string levels in Green-Schwarz language or in NSR language. So if I were to count an NSR language, I would guess r equals to 1. And that will give me, r equals to 2, because I want this guy. And that would give a power 2. If I were to count in an NSR, in a Green-Schwarz kind of language, then morally R should be 1, because it's really just two derivatives to go one level up. So then you would get the 1. Based on experience with short operators treated semi-classically, the guess is that the counting should be done as a Green-Schwarz counting. And then
Konishi
would be level 1, yes.
But then the perturbative result would be in agreement with your problem.
More questions?
Okay, well, let's thank Radu again.